Hello and welcome to Our Dad's Died with me, Tom.
And me, Rich.
This week we have got a really, really fascinating guy on the podcast.
Yeah, he genuinely is. His name is Dr. Dean. Ooh, doctor? He was doctor. He's doctor, isn't he?
He better be.
I'm pretty sure. We'll say
if he's not a doctor, then what the fuck are we doing?
And that blows this whole case wide open. His name is Dr. Dean Burnett, and we're going to say he's a doctor. He introduces himself at the start of the podcast with all of his various the strings to his bow, so I won't try and do them now. But he's a fascinating man, an expert in the brain, and a guy who sadly lost his dad during the COVID pandemic.
I can confirm he is a doctor of neuroscience, so it's fine.
He's a doctor of neuroscience. Thank God. Imagine we got this far in and then it turned out he was a charlatan.
Charlatan. A doctor of, or just a doctor of something really, really, really unrelated.
Yeah.
Like a doctor of media studies. Ah, oh, come on, mate. Talk to us about neuroscience. He's just watched a lot of episodes of ER.
Where do you get off, Dean? No, but he's a fantastic writer, a fantastic scientist, and someone that I didn't expect to come on. I messaged him out of the blue just to see if he'd be interested. He said yes, he came on. I was quite intimidated, and you may notice during this episode that I forgot to be funny at any point during it, because I was quite sort of overawed by his presence. So fortunately Tom picked up the baton and was very funny. I was sort of deadly serious throughout.
Dean was quite funny as well, to be fair to him.
Dean was also very funny, yeah.
And that comes with the territory. For our international listeners, at one point, Dean mentions S4C. That's a Welsh language television channel, which is part funded by the BBC. It's you know, they'll do like rugby, but in Welsh, or like Poply Cwm, which is a well-known soap opera here.
Yeah. Like Welsh EastEnders.
It's like Welsh EastEnders, which is sort of like London Corrie.
Yeah, which is kind of like a Manchester version of Emmerdale. Sorry, Emmerdale is like if Neighbours was set in Yorkshire.
In Yorkshire, and Neighbours is like sort of like an Australian The Archers. You can imagine that, but in Australia.
Yes.
Similar level of pop stars have come from both shows, I think.
Yeah, that's true.
Right, well, enough of the chit-chat nonsense. Here is Dr. Dean Burnett talking about neuroscience and grief and the brain.
I was having a think just before you joined about how to introduce you to the podcast listeners. Tom is drinking a Welsh-themed beer that he's very proudly showing off to Dean.
Nice.
I approve. It wasn't a requirement of me being here, but you know, it's nice to be made to feel welcome in a strange roundabout way. Yeah.
I mean, to what extent that is Welsh, I'm not sure, because it's a Heineken, which I believe is...
Yeah,
it's German, but brewed in Burton.
It's got a dragon on it, and as far as most media is concerned, that's all it takes.
Yeah,
it can be a bratwurst, it can be a pile of chili. Just put a dragon on it; it's fine. That makes it Welsh.
Then it's officially Welsh.
Apparently so. Yes.
Yeah, I was thinking about how to introduce you because you seem to have quite a lot of strings to your bow. So
it's an odd CV I've accumulated over the years. Almost 90% by accident. So,
how do you introduce yourself? How do you sort of define what you do and who you are?
I guess these days people want it as succinct as possible. So whenever I'm sort of said, "Oh, doing a talk," I say, "Oh, can you just how do we refer to you?" And like, well, I just say Dean Burnett, neuroscientist and author. Really, I mean that does sort of it's a very brief way of putting it. But those are my two things that I'm mostly known for at the moment. I write books about brains, so it's a combination of the two. But if you want to argue, you know, go fully, I'm a full-time author, doctor of neuroscience. Did stand-up comedy since 2004. Still do it when I'm asked, which is rare. Even pre-pandemic, that was rare because you know, like the old Oscar Wilde thing. I've gigged everywhere once, and not really in a huge demand to be coming back. But so we've got a Guardian writer, lecturer, psychiatry tutor, like I say, lots of different inserts into the old CV. So I'm just a general science part of the moment, I suppose. If you want someone to talk about science, that's what I do. If and when my expertise is relevant, which it seems to be quite often, because it's about the brain, isn't it? Think name one thing humans do which doesn't involve the brain. You can't, because it's by default, it's involved in everything we do. So,
oh, actually, that thing where the doctor hits you on the knee and you kick.
Oh, yes. That's a reflex. It's entirely spinal, but someone's got to use. They've got to hit the knee.
And clever! So, turn it around. Very good.
So someone's got to choose to do that. There was a Brazilian publication which interviewed me a few years back now, and it's to do with Professor Canavero. He's that guy who keeps maintaining he's going to do a head swap operation, and must be a translation issue because I was then credited in the English version of the article as Dr. Burnett brackets an expert in raising the dead. So that was a strange thing to add to my bio that day, yes.
To be fair, are you not surely... Are we all not the same level of experts when it comes to raising the dead?
I would say yes, I suppose. I mean,
we're all an expert in raising the dead, right?
I have no less knowledge than you about the matter. So
no one has more expertise than someone else, I suppose.
I guess. I mean, you could argue that. I mean, if someone's going to make a legal case about it, I guess I could have to defend myself on those fronts. But in my defence, I didn't make the claim. It was attributed to me. It was an honorific.
I mean, what a skill to have, though. I mean, it does sort of tie into the theme of this podcast. And that's brilliant. Another part of the reason that we've brought you on today is that you sadly lost your dad about 18 months ago. Is that right?
Yeah, April 2020. He was one of the very early victims of the COVID-19 pandemic, completely out of the blue, completely unexpected. He was only 58. He had no prior health problems. He was a bigger guy, but not to the point of, you suspect he'll have serious health issues or anything. And obviously it was the start of lockdown. I couldn't see him. I couldn't visit him at any point. And I was funeral socially distanced. And the usual rituals of loss and mourning and grief, which involve usually people rallying around to help you, to take care of your kids, do your shopping for you, just people make gestures to comfort you and to do something, and they couldn't have any of that. So I had to experience this incredibly profound grief whilst also maintaining appearances for my own kids, who were very young at the time. They were 4 and 8. So, and they just lost their grandfather in a very scary new situation. So I couldn't afford to succumb to grief for them. And yeah, it's been a very, very shaping experience, very impactful, very, very refining one. So I imagine you both have this thing about I'm a very very different person to how I was before this all happened. I think I'm maybe a better one, a wiser one, definitely. But still something I'd rather not have gone through, if I'm being completely honest about that.
It's wisdom that you'd rather not have, isn't it, most of the time?
Yeah, and it's actually I do sort of find that, because I'm on the record quite a lot of being quite vehemently opposed to the whole toxic positivity thing, thinking of, this current trend for people saying you have to be happy at all times, and if you're not happy, then there's something wrong. But perhaps the most dangerous part is you can just choose to be happy. Like, the only disability is a bad attitude. And I think this is a seriously unhealthy way to live your life in terms of a mindset and an ideology or a practice. But I did a book, Psychological, which is out 2019 originally, and then just print version last year. But I spoke to Guy Kelly about it, and he's one of the contributors because he's dealt with mental health stuff a lot. But one thing I asked a lot of my people I got involved was, do you think your mental health issues have improved you in any way, or been beneficial? I said, well, yeah, it's helped me learn this, or I've understood this. And I said, well, do you think they're good? Do you think it's a good thing? Like, would you rather not not change anything? And he's like, no, I'd rather not have the mental health problems. Because yes, it has taught me stuff, but it's like saying if you break both your legs, you suddenly get a much better understanding of which London tube stations have disability access. But it's helpful knowledge, but I'd rather not have broken legs. It's it's a very small sort of it's a silver lining, but it's still a lining. But given the choice, I'd rather not have massive trauma to the process and deal with it.
Yeah. I think that's quite reasonable.
I think so, but it's one of the things people don't say very often. Like, you know, well, you know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. You know, it's you know, it's all part of the higher purpose. No, no, I just, I'd rather this not have happened, and I think it's perfectly logical to say that.
And did you find any of that toxic positivity in the way that people responded to your? Because I read one of your blogs about it today, and it's something that Tom and I have talked about quite a lot on this podcast, of the messages that you get in the immediate aftermath of losing someone, and. You spoke about how they made you quite angry, and I had the exact same response of just finding it infuriating that people were getting in touch with sort of useless aphorisms and...
Yeah, yeah. I remember, like, that's a personal, you know, thing, which, like, I don't bear anyone any ill will. I keep on stress that, but it is the case. Like, I know nobody set out to make me feel worse. You know, the worst time of my life. I don't know anyone's motivations, and I know it all came from a good place, but like you say, it was, I mean, I haven't gone through anything like this, you know, this traumatic loss outside the context of lockdown. So all my experiences will be infused with that, which I think, you know, it makes it unique, but I can't compare it to that time I lost a close relative outside of lockdown, you know, it was, but yeah, one of the things which did really sort of get me really teeth grinding was all the messages I got from people saying, like, I've just heard, I'm so sorry for your loss, which is a totally fine thing to say. But you know, I just wish there's something I could do. I just wish there's something I could do to help. And like, constantly thinking, yes, but you know there isn't. Even like outside of lockdown, like, you're messaging me, you're an old Facebook friend who now lives in Somerset or like Grimsby. Like, yeah. If only there was some way I could travel 400 miles to see a casual acquaintance from 50 years ago and help. This is just to make you feel better. This is you saying, well, I said that. I am, you know, I made the effort, I made the gesture, I made the promise of being willing to help. Therefore, I'm a good person and I feel better. And for me, like, it hasn't changed my situation. All it means is I've got to scrape together some what little, you know, mental fortitude I have left to be polite to this person and say, oh, thanks, yeah. And knowing I don't feel thankful. I just feel like, you know, if anything, you've just wasted my brain cells reading that message, which will do nothing for me and help you. And because of etiquette, because of society, I've got to be the one who says, oh, yeah, I know, really appreciate that. And like, well, I don't appreciate it.
What a burn from a neurologist to say, you have wasted my brain cells. You're like, and that's real as well, because I know, right?
You're the first guest that we've had on who lost someone during COVID. Mm-hmm. And I guess part of losing someone during lockdown is you don't have access to, like, you couldn't have had a normal funeral, so to speak. And you couldn't have, like, your usual routine. You couldn't go anywhere or get away from it. All of that, I guess, is also taken away from you.
Yeah, totally.
So how was the experience of a lockdown funeral?
Well, I'm going to say bloody awful, because I mean, no one enjoys the funeral of a close loved relative, do they? So that's a default. That's, I think that's fair to say that. But yeah, it was. I mean, I've thought about this a lot, in that funerals are necessary, and although they're ostensibly for the deceased, they're not really. They're for the ones who are left. It's something we can do to honour the person, to celebrate the person, to get together and be sad together. And because humans are such social creatures, our brains are intensely social by default. And with that comes empathy, emotional contagion. We express our emotions via other people. So being able to get together other people and have a great big sad, for want of a better description, is healthy. It'll speed up the process. It'll give your brain, input and information it needs to work through these intense emotions you're going through. But to have a lockdown one, it sort of spoiled that in some way. I mean, it was surreal in part because I was the most technically minded member of the media family. Ended up being my job to work out how to do a Facebook live stream of my father's funeral, because obviously we only have 14 people here. He was a very, very popular man. We lived in Port Talbot, so funeral procession, there were people lying in the streets, and there were like loads of them. And like I've described it, imagine if Princess Diana's funeral was remade by S4C for some weird reason. They did a sort of reenactment. Why they do that, I don't know. But if they did, they would look like this. And yeah, so that was nice to know that they. But there were a lot of people who couldn't attend. Like there were only 14 of us allowed in the building. Had to see it some ways, or had to set up a Facebook live stream of my father's funeral, which is it's a completely true statement. It'll never not seem surreal just to say it out loud.
Yeah,
I had to do a Facebook live stream of my father. I've said it a load of times since, but it gets even more weird every time I say it. It's like...
Yeah, all the words make sense, but they sort of shouldn't, should they?
No, they don't belong together. It's jarring. There was something so mundane, something so modern.
The first thing that's popped into my head when you said a Facebook live stream is that whenever I've watched one, they have the little thing where you can click like or something midway through and a little thumb floats up.
Yeah.
And I wonder, because people... will have clicked that or thought of clicking the little heart, and you wonder at what point during the ceremony do I send a little red heart floating up to say.
I wasn't watching any of it because I was in the ceremony, but like once someone actually accidentally presses the blooming laugh emoji instead, like, this is really profound. And so that was just one aspect of it. But yeah, it was, my father was again a very gregarious, outgoing, popular man. So to do a funeral for him, which was essential, but have it with just 14 people, such a in and out, done and dusted fashion, felt wrong. Then we actually only had the wake finally a month ago today.
Oh wow!
So it's one of the things that we can't do a stripped down, watered down, socially distanced wake for him. That would just be disrespectful. Mm-hmm. It had to be a big party. There was no. Black allowed, is all Hawaiian shirts and colourful clothes, and as per his wishes. And there was music and dancing, and people obviously getting absolutely smashed together. And it was really nice. It was really helpful and healthy and cathartic and stuff. But in a way, I'm sort of glad it was so long after he passed, because it gave us everyone time to get over the worst of it, I suppose. You know, it's not quite so raw at the moment. And I think, in that case, I think there's something to be said for, because usually you have funeral wake same day or day after each other. It's all, it all happens when the grief is still very, very acute, very, very fresh. And so to have it with a more sort of, after the wound has sort of healed over a bit, I think that maybe makes it a more enjoyable experience.
Is there scope for doing that if you've had a wake already? Sort of
I don't
like
say why not. I mean,
renewing your burial.
I suppose there's that. But
have a wake again.
Reawakening.
That's better. What about it goes back to that necromancer thing. Although you are the expert on
apparently
it.
So. Yeah, well, no, we're all experts. You said that.
Oh yeah, of course. Is it? I mean, I don't know. Is that an idea? You had one 18 months removed, and you said it was. A kind of good feeling. I guess what I'm asking is, would you have another?
we are sort of thinking the idea of doing like a regular Christmas party. Because you always used to do a big Christmas party every year, so we thought about
there
doing
you
that.
Are.
The traditions we have sort of are what they are, but there's no rules about that. And the pandemic has shown us that. You can't work from home. It turns out you can. A lot of people can do it, and it's fine. And you can't expect people to do this. So we did. People will keep apart for. The best part of a year, and so it's challenged a lot of just assumptions we have. So, like I say, we assume you can only have one wake. Why? Unless that's ever been written down anywhere.
I think what Tom's angling for is he wants to have another wake. And as Dean says, Tom, there's no rules. You can have as many wakes. I imagine the more wakes you have, the number of attendees will diminish eventually.
It's like weddings, like. People at your fourth wedding, like, is this one?
When Tom was inviting people to his dad's 17th wake, I feel like I see time already again for another. Okay.
Yeah. I feel like you just don't want to buy your own beer. I feel like that's where this is going.
You've absolutely nailed it. I was going to ask you a question that I think is potentially quite a stupid question, but my role on this podcast largely is to be quite stupid.
A serious one today, though, Rich.
I know I'm
quite role reversed.
I read a lot of Dean's stuff, so I'm genuinely very interested in.
Big fan.
So I'm meant to be funny, but I've decided to not be funny this time. I'll try and slip a joke in later on. We can edit one in.
Great.
Yeah, edit one in, yeah. Also, edit some applause in too, because that would be even better. Yeah. It's generic background applause. He's got a big office for the sound of things.
but my potentially stupid question is, I've written it down. Okay, where was it? I think I've flagged it as, is this a stupid question? Oh, yeah, here we go. I've written what, comma, scientifically, comma, happens to the brain when you experience grief.
Ooh,
is that a good question, or is that a stupid question?
It's not stupid. I mean, it's a complex one, really.
After you've done it scientifically, can you do it non-scientifically as well, like sort of fantasy answer?
I suppose, yeah, but there's not really any limit to that answer.
Exactly.
Can you make up something which isn't true? Yeah, I can definitely do that.
Yeah, exactly.
But there's not really restrictions on that. Yeah, it is. Like I said, it's. I've actually just written a whole book about this, so I'm happy to wax lyrical about it for as long as you like.
Yeah, read aloud. Yeah. Cover to cover.
It's still an audiobook.
I suppose, yeah. It's not been published yet or edited, so it's kind of like a third too long already. So, a lot of things happen. It's, like I mentioned already, human brain is an extremely social organ, and we define ourselves by the relationships we maintain with those around us. And the closest relationships are the most important, you know, the ones you have with your parents, your partners, your spouses, your lovers, your children, your closest friends. These sort of, they like form the bedrock of our psyche in many ways. Like these are the people we get our validation from, or like we calibrate our sense of how the world works around them. So they become, you know, our relationships are a big part of our identity. So when you lose someone you're really close to, or even like not especially intimately, or you know, you don't have heart to hearts every day, but someone who's a big part of your life. I mean, you can lose a parent, you know, you can be estranged from a parent for many years and still lose them, and it's still deeply, fundamentally affecting, because you know, whatever you think of them at the moment, they were the first person you looked up to. Like they shaped who you are, they made you who you are. And losing someone like that in an irrefutable way, knowing that you know, they are gone and there's no way they're coming back and you can't do anything about it, it's a massive shock to the brain for various reasons. A big part of it is because our brains work, or our minds work perhaps better than brains, because we have our brains generate a mental model of how the world works, like all our experiences, memories, understandings, beliefs, attitudes, expectations, thought processes, stuff like that. They're all sort of this big, huge blob in our head, sort of cognitive blob, which then says, like, this is how the world works. This is what happens in the world. Here's how I interact with the world, and based on all this knowledge. And when someone close to you dies, that's a huge part of your understanding of the world is gone, because you never, even though you know it's going to happen, you know, at some point, nobody lives forever. You know, everyone you're close to will die at some point. That's purely theoretical. Experiencing it, it's a whole other thing. So, like with me, like that's with our fathers, you know, this is someone who's just been part of our lives, part of our world, our entire life. And they're gone now. And that's just a massive cognitive emotional shock at the most basic level. But also, freighted with that is the sense of, like I say, loss of control, which is something our brain doesn't like. Like we lost someone very, very close to us, very important to us. We couldn't do anything about it, and we can't do anything about it now. That's fundamentally stressful for the brain as well, knowing that. And another thing which upsets any human brain is perceived unfairness or injustice. And if someone you're close to, there will be no circumstances where you think, yeah, it's good that they died. It was the right result. It's just not going to happen, is it? If it's someone you actually do care about.
Yeah.
It's your most hated enemy, or like a war criminal or a serial killer, fair enough. You might think, well, it's probably for the best that they got bumped off by that during that shootout. But there's no way you can think one of your own family members or loved ones, that's the right result. It's never going to happen. They died. They should not have died. It was not fair that they died. But it's happened, and there's absolutely nothing you can do about it. So it's like three massive shocks to how your mind works when you lose someone like that. Our brain's good at that. It does work through emotions, but the thing about how the brain processes emotions is it processes by doing. The parts of your brain which sort of integrate emotional stimulation and experiences into your sort of overall sense of self, those are the same parts of the brain which help us experience emotions. So you have to experience them in order to get through them. So anyway, that's why bottling them up and suppressing them isn't helpful. It's actually counterproductive. The stimulation just sits there, you know, disrupting things, getting in the way. And that's, you know, important to know that. But anyway, it can go too far the other way. There's times you can have pathological grief. It's like something like over 9 months later, you still haven't changed from the initial state of loss. And some psychiatrists sort of say that's analogous to addiction. People become addicted to the memories of their loved ones because they don't, you know, it's more comfortable thinking about them, remembering them as they were than accepting the world as it is without them in it. And that can, you know, that's unhealthy. That's damaging to do that because you're denying reality. And that's when grief can become a clinical problem. It's a real thing. But one thing also, people have asked me this, they go, the five stages of grief, that's one thing that comes up a lot. So that's the mainstream understanding. But that's actually been quite substantially warped by the mainstream scientific portrayal. It doesn't mean that we have five stages of grief and everyone goes through them all in order. And once you get through the last one, you are now done grieving, or you're better.
You're fine.
No, Dr. Lossoff, the little psychiatrist who came up with it, even she said, no, this, I didn't say it's just five things in order for everyone. It's just that from her notes, from her records, most people's experience of grief usually involve one or more of these five things. That's what she meant. It didn't say, they have to happen in order. They can happen repeatedly. You can skip bits. You can have them in different orders. They can last for ages, but not, you know, so the whole five stages thing is, it's a mainstream distortion of the truth.
We were talking about the five stages of grief the other day, because that's not something that I don't think I've particularly recognised in my grief. I don't know about yourself or Tom, whether that's been...
Yeah, it's not not been anywhere near that ordered for me. Again, with the fact that it was all happening during lockdown, so there were other, you know, factors which were just throwing things for a loop. But I found, you know, I would go through three or four stages in a day, in the morning, and then have the sort of... But it's also like the whole something that happens in depression a lot that people don't really think of. It's flat affect. You just sort of feel nothing. You feel numb. You have no emotional state. And I think that doesn't get acknowledged enough in grief. Like, you're just in... There's several days my brain just goes, I don't have anything left to give today. I'm just going to put it into autopilot. We'll just cruise for... We'll just get through this one.
I mean, my main understanding of the five stages of grief came from that one episode of Scrubs where they...
Scrubs.
Well, now that is the topic area, though, because what me and Rich think is, as you alluded to there, there are more than just five stages of grief. There are lots of different possible stages of grief. And we've got some pitches for additional stages of grief that we could have.
It's like a sort of weird, strangely morbid Dragon's Den.
I suppose so. All right, Dean. you're the dragon. Dragon Dean.
I'll see if I'll invest in the stages of grief.
Exactly right. Well, Rich, lead the way.
Well, I mean, one of mine was going to be nothing, which is essentially what you talked about there, the feeling of complete numbness. So, and I guess this is a bit more, I'm thinking on my feet here, but one significant stage for me, and I'd also be interested to see if there is like a neurological explanation for this. There was a stage where I pooed a lot. And in the immediate aftermath of my dad dying, and my mum had the same experience because I was at home with her.
I didn't experience this. I just want to say, before the listener thinks we're all just pooing ourselves, I want to make clear,
okay,
when Rich's dad died, I was fine.
Not ringing bells for me either, but go on.
we're talking 3, 4, 5, 6 times a day. Very regular, consistent in that sense. The consistency itself was inconsistent, I would say. So, is there an argument that the sixth stage of grief
is shitting.
Diarrhea. I mean, what's that stool scale they do? The grief stool. No one wants that one. It's like regular poop, but it's grey. I mean, there are like potential explanations. I don't, I didn't experience this myself, but there's some people argue that fear should be in the stages of grief. You know, it is in there, but some people take it out of them. And I could, that makes sense because, you know, you had a, you know, before the loss, you had what you felt was quite a safe life. You understood how the world worked. And, you know, like you don't think, you know, just it's a mental defense mechanism. You don't think bad things happen to you. Then the worst thing does happen to someone you're very close to, you're quite closely connected to. It rings all sorts of alarm bells in your head. So it's, oh God, no, that means it could happen to me. That means no one's safe. You know, so when you're afraid, you do tend to have, you know, intestinal reactions because if your sympathetic nervous system is kicking in, the whole fight or flight stuff, and you know, it, amongst other things, it wants to just, you know, offload any excess weight so we can run or fight better. But there's also like the vagus nerve, which is the one of the cranial nerves, but connects the brain to like all of our organs. It's the one which links everything in the body to the brain. So vagus nerve functioning has a big role in depression and general mind mental state, and things like hangry, you know, when you're hungry, so you get irritable, or like the gut brain axis, the fact that, you know, you eat certain things that affects your mood, and the vagus nerve seems to be part of that. So, you know, if you are, if your brain is in a, you know, a state of turmoil, you know, via the vagus nerve, that could be spread to other parts of the body, e.g. the digestive system. So, you know, there's too much activity up here, so it's spreading down and, you know, leading to
sharing the load.
So increased output, for want of a better description, yes.
So I mean, the key question is, would you accept pooing as a stage of grief, or do we have to umbrella that under fear?
I'm out.
it's a no to pooing. I mean, it also suggests that I get very scared every time I have a coffee as well.
But yeah, there's other things at work, of course.
All right, well, I've got one. I would like to put in, for the record, I would like to put in hunger as a stage of grief. A sincere sense of unabated, unstoppable hunger. I remember eating and having an inability to feel full. Like, the signal of fullness was no longer functioning in my system. And I had been dieting prior to that point, but still, you know, just being unable to feel full. And so eating to the point of being bloated and uncomfortable, and yet still wanting to just shove just cake and just lovely biscuits, you know, just like Jammy Dodgers. Just I must have eaten 30 Jammy Dodgers a day after he died. Yeah. So what do you reckon about hunger?
There's lots of potential things for that as well. I mean, you said you were on a diet before it happened, and so, like, you know, maybe you could be, your brain's going, right, I've surrendered food from my life, that's the thing I've lost. Then you lose your father, and your brain's going, I just don't have the capacity to lose two things like this. It was a fundamental thing. So, like, all your, you know, your internal discipline was diverted to keeping yourself emotionally intact, and like the whole self-control about eating was like jettisoned right away. That's something that could happen there. But at the more sort of fundamental chemical level, that one of the reasons people do binge eat or indulge in fried, because there's a chemical reaction to it. And when you eat high calorie foods, it relaxes you. It reduces your stress levels, because one thing, you know, we evolved in the wild, in nature, where high calorie food is very hard to come by. So if you did find it, then you should take on as much as you can at one go, because there's no guarantee you'll find any again. So build up your fat stores once you've got a chance. And your brain likes that. It finds out, good, that's good. We're surviving here. So again, if the fear thing had kicked in and you think, right, you know, we're all at risk, I can't guarantee I'll be safe, then it could just be a fundamental reflex, your brain going, okay, so you've already dieted, you know you're not invulnerable. Just fill up, because, you know, that's one thing we can do to feel better. But also, it does release, you know, it's an oxytocin effect, and it does have a stress suppressing reaction. That's why stress eating is a thing. because you actually, your brain go, right, I'm really stressed. How do I stop that? I know if I eat lots of doughy things, I know that'll make me feel better. So I'll do that. And I'll keep doing that until I do feel better. And in the state of serious grief, you probably won't feel better. So you just could, a feedback circuit could have kicked in there. So it's possible, yeah.
Did you experience the great munch?
I might have done. I was too drunk for most of the time
to actually. The great drink, yeah.
Well, yeah. Well, again, it was like I was completely alone and cut off, and it was like, yeah. I mean, I like a glass of wine anyway, so it wasn't a huge leap. But you know, I definitely was drinking more than I would have been otherwise. I did indulge more in food, but I never experienced that sort of that ravenousness that you described. But could be because I was just using alcohol to dull it, perhaps. So
you were getting all the calories from the alcohol, so
exactly, yeah. So yeah. It amounts to the same thing, really.
I also didn't experience. I did experience
the great munch. Hunger,
the great munch, but yeah. That potentially was because I mean I was turning it over. I mean, I was really going through it. Okay, my other pitch for a stage was guilt, and
yeah,
that seems to be quite a prominent stage in a lot of the people that we've spoken to, is sort of guilt of this, I guess, the survivor's guilt that people talk about.
Absolutely,
but then just
yeah.
also guilt of all the stuff that you didn't do or did do and can never undo,
yeah,
so to speak.
Absolutely, you know, that should be a more prominent part of it, because it's, I think it's arguably unavoidable. I mean, even if you did everything you could, the fact is you did everything and they still died. You know, in the subconscious level, you're going to think, I didn't do enough, or what I did was wrong because the outcome I was going for didn't happen. So you will feel a sense of like, I failed them because they have died and you didn't want that to happen. So, you know, at the most fundamental part of your psyche, that's an unavoidable conclusion. I didn't want to. I tried to stop it from happening. It happened anyway. I failed. I failed them. Again, it doesn't make any logical sense if you know the, look at the actual facts, but the brain is seldom is logical when it comes to something so emotional as this. It's because, like I said, you don't expect your father or anyone close to you to die, especially not suddenly, prematurely. So you don't think, oh, I better treat every conversation like it's my last one. There are so many regrets of things I never said to my father, but they were, we didn't have absolutely sunshine and roses relationship. There are plenty of things I would like to have said to him while he was alive. Sort of points of order, like, this is why you need to, which I didn't say to him, which I'm not unhappy about. I think we're good. At least we weren't on like worse terms than we could have been when he died. We were on good terms. We were fine. There was no problem. But he had done many things which I let fester. Go, no, I need to have words about this at some point. Can't carry on doing this. And never came up at the end, and I'm glad of that, because that would have been a pointless thing. If I'd known he was going to die, I would never mention it anyway. You have all these things you want to say, want to tell them, want to do with them, and you think it'll be fine. No, we'll do it at some point, but then they die at some point, and it's never going to come now. So you feel guilt about that. All the plans you made and didn't tell them and didn't put any effort into because you didn't think you had to, those will make you feel guilty. Just the fact that, unless you did absolutely everything you could for that person all the time, which is physically and mentally impossible, you're going to feel like you failed them in some way because they're gone now. And you didn't want that, but it wasn't part of your plans. So yeah, I think it's an inevitable consequence of loss and grief.
And then there's also that weird secondary guilt that you talked about, sort of meta guilt, where you're guilty for feeling good afterwards.
Yeah. Guilty that you're not sad enough.
Which makes even less sense.
Totally, yeah. I mean, that comes back to the sort of toxic positivity thing. It's like the cultural influence of people telling you how you should be feeling when it's not really anyone else's decision. Someone said to you, you're still sad. It's been like 6 months now. Like, well, that really isn't your, it's not your call. It's not your, it's not your place to make any sort of comment as to when it would be convenient for me and wider society if I wasn't still sad or grieving. But again, who gives a damn? that's immaterial to all matter. But yeah, people have these expectations of how you should or shouldn't be, and how you're supposed to grieve, which is It comes from trial and error. I don't say like it's not kind of, no one just plucked it out of the air. These are things people have built up over many, many years of seeing people go through grief and the rituals that evolve around it. But yeah, it's, you know, the societal side of it, the cultural influences can be kind of unhelpful with that, as in, you know, well, I'm supposed to be sad now. I'm supposed to be Mr. Johnny, no fun for the next 6 months. So if I feel like I'm feeling better for a day or two, then like I have failed in my duty as a grieving person. And yeah, that becomes very confusing.
And that is exactly leading into my other pitch, which I haven't got a very succinct phrase for. It's not the great munch, but it's just that feeling of feeling guilty, which occurs under very specific circumstances of feeling good in a very odd setting. For example, in July this year, I went trampolining with a friend in a trampoline park, and whilst bouncing on a trampoline, jumping in its thing, landing my back, I thought, oh, my dad died, and I'm just on a trampoline.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
And it's a feeling of regret, but in a strange setting where you can't really outwardly show it, because it would be, as weird as that is, it would be even weirder if I was to then say to my friend on his birthday at a trampoline park, oh, I'm sad about my dad dying. That would be...
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
A thing to throw on him mid-trampoline.
Yeah, well, that's like that comes back into the thing you said, to discuss about earlier about you have this mental model of how the world works, and part of that is what they call schemas, certain ways of thinking and certain expectations which differ from context to context. So you know, if when those things sort of overlap or they cross over, they can be quite disconcerting. So like, if you like think, the example I have is if you go to a restaurant, you have a restaurant schema, you know how a restaurant works. Is that you go in, you show them to your table, you have a menu, you ask for certain foods, they bring them to you, they take the plates away again, you pay for it. That's how a restaurant works. You know that. But if you go to someone's house for dinner, you don't then go and sit down and say, come on then, what's available? And like you insist on them making you certain things, because that's, you're in someone's house. The restaurant schema doesn't apply. Similarly, if you go to the beach or the swimming pool, you have a swimming pool schema. Like, this is a place where people walk around in their underwear and they're wet, and kids run around and there's lots of water, and you can lie down on a sun lounger. So that's your schema there. So if you're in a restaurant, someone walks past you in soaking wet underwear, you think that's not right. That's the wrong part. They're not meant to be here. That's atypical of this. Whereas if you're at the swimming pool, you wouldn't think of it. If you're at the swimming pool, someone in a tuxedo comes up and asks you what you want to eat. What are you doing here? That's weird. Stop it. So you have these schemas. You have these understandings of how things work. So you have birthday party trampoline type schema. Like, this is a fun event. This is a celebratory event. Grief isn't meant to be here. Grief isn't meant to manifest in this situation, but grief doesn't care. Grief isn't something you can just shut off like a bulb when you close the fridge. It's just everywhere. It follows you around. It's like dropping a red hot coal in a filing cabinet. It's like, I don't care what your system is. I'm just going to sit here and smolder and spread everywhere. And so yeah, when you have that, it just pops up in such weird places. Like, my wife is at work during the second lockdown, or the summer one, whichever one it was, and I had to take the kids out. So it might only been like 3 months since my father had died, and I had to be dad of the kids. And I sort of remember having a sort of brief grief attack during in the queue in the ice cream van. I said, "Do you want to 99? Yeah, chocolate sauce." It's really, really weird. Like, this came out of nowhere, and I think someone walked past and they played a tune that she was a fan of, like, so then it kicked off the whole memory thing, and then like, you're a strawberry sauce, kids. It's a really weird situation to be in.
And it's a lot to explain to that ice cream man as well, isn't it, in that moment?
Well, I think it was a busy day. He looked quite harassed as well. So you're like, oh, God, yeah. You as well, is it? Yeah.
I had a similar, like, weird, like, inconvenient grief.
Love inconvenient grief.
That's a good word for it, yeah.
After my dad had died, I had to go on a stag do, which was the first of my friends to get married. We went on a stag do, which was like bad for a number of reasons, mainly because it was in Blackpool in January. Oof. Which okay. Terrible. We went paintballing at like 7 a.m. and it was -1. It was awful. But that night we were in some terrible karaoke bar and someone started singing a song that my dad had loved and was like a song that I always associated with him. And I was sort of dancing with my friends and then had to go and sit on a bar stool and couldn't stop myself from crying. And some sort of northern woman in her 40s came over and was trying to dance with me on this stool while I was in tears.
Yeah, an inconvenient grief, yes.
And it was the thing that was most inconvenient about it is the song that set it off was Afro Man's Because I Got High.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, yeah. that's an odd one to cry to.
it was such an odd, surreal moment, having this 40-year-old like shaking my arms about and trying to dance with me while I wept to Afro Man's one and only hit in the middle of Blackpool.
I mean, it makes perfect sense. Apart from, I don't know why Afro Man would be one of his favourite songs, but I don't know the guy. So
he had odd tasting. Yeah. The other one was OPM's Heaven Is a Half Pipe. He loved that as well.
Frankly, great. They're two absolute bangers.
Yeah,
I don't know why you're giving him a hard time. These are classics.
I'm not opposed to the songs. It's like when someone says so. The song that makes you think of my father. Those are really the ones which come up, but it's probably something. Yeah,
I think his dad just said, "Now that's what I call music 41 or something." Can he just use that?
Yeah. That's my guess. CD, you know what I mean? Played on a loop.
Yeah.
Well, I wanted it played as we carried the coffin out of the funeral. I wanted Because I Got High played, but that was vetoed quite strongly by everybody else involved.
Yeah. Very disappointing.
I can see that, but I think you're in the right there. That's
yes, thank you. That's well, when I have my second wake, that's going to be
there. We go.
That'll be the one.
Well, Rich, we've done it. We finally had a scientist on the show to explain why you pooed so much after Daddy died.
It's finally happened. It is good. It's good to get the validation that that was a problem with my brain.
Yeah. I was just wondering if we could also just have a look at some copyright situation. I don't know if we want to put some copyrights in.
Sure.
I feel like The Great Munch.
Yep.
I feel like that could add to our previous ones, the old The Emotionless Husk, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And who can forget Bottle It Up?
Yeah, Bottle It Up. One of the all-time great catchphrases. We should get some T-shirts done.
I think the great Munch is I was really fun. I'm really really happy listening back to me say that because I was like, yeah, no, that is I'd forgotten all about that.
Yeah, I also really really liked the idea of the second wake.
Oh yes, the second wake was fantastic, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I was thinking about that a lot and I realised so what we pitched for second wake at was specifically when the first one didn't go so well for whatever reason.
Yeah, because of the recent death in your family, maybe.
Yeah, maybe you're a bit sad. So the second wake is the second wake is when you have another pop at it to be a bit more celebratory. And it struck me that, you know, my grandma and my uncle died during COVID, and the second wake, you know, the next time that our whole family was together was my wedding.
Oh, of course, yeah.
So I'm a bit worried that my wedding might have been the old second.
That was the
double.
Second wake.
Yeah.
I mean, if it was, it was a good party.
Yeah, we had the right knees up, didn't we?
Yeah, and we did. Your dad was mentioned a number of times.
A number of times we sang "You'll Never Walk Alone," didn't we?
Yeah.
I was a bit worried in the build-up to the wedding that wouldn't land, but I felt it did. There was a little bit in that. We just said there about my grandma, and it really sparked a memory that I haven't talked about on the podcast incredibly, which is, and when my grandma died during COVID, I was charged with murder. And I thought, yeah, this is outrageous. You know, yeah. A woman almost 100 years old dies clearly of natural causes.
Clearly.
How could they? But the knife was always suspicious. She died during COVID, and there were only allowed 10 people were allowed at the funeral. If you can recall those incredible times, I know we sort of can't because the media's moved on from COVID. It was a long time ago, in the eyes of the context of what's happening right now. But we did all just live through it quite recently. So she dies, and only 10 people can go to the funeral, and I was charged with filming this thing and live streaming it.
Yeah, Facebook. I remember this.
So this, so I was live streaming the... Well, I'm sure I told you about it at the time, because I thought it was so outrageous. Well, I was live streaming this, and I didn't know a real way to do this, because obviously there's people who couldn't go, right? So I just thought, well, I'm just going to put it on Facebook video, you know, like privately. And then people can click the link. I'll send the link and then people can watch it, you know. Only I failed to make it private. Again, possibly because I was at my grandma's funeral and I found that to be quite sad.
Yeah.
Considering that's my dad's mum, you know, so it's dead dad's dead mum, dead dad.
Yeah, yeah.
but which shouldn't really be a problem. But when I looked on the Facebook, it popped up to say someone had joined, and it was someone I went to school with just 20 years ago. 20 years has passed. They're on Facebook. It's during COVID, so they haven't got much to do. I'll give them that. But they see, oh, Grandma Gherkin's funeral.
Granny Gherkin's gone. They watched
the whole thing.
Really?
They were there the duration. They didn't go. I couldn't just stop it. So I didn't know what to do, so I just let it continue, and they watched the whole funeral.
Wow. I mean, what is going on in your life that you log onto Facebook in the middle of what I assume is probably like a working day, and you see that someone you don't know that well is live streaming? Actually, to be fair, if someone I went to high school with, if I went on Facebook and it said they were live streaming a funeral, I'd be like, well, this is chaos. I'm absolutely going to watch. Yeah. Of course I'm going to watch a live streamed funeral of someone I barely know.
Of course, it would be crazy not to, actually. Not watching it would have been the mad thing in that situation. But bizarre, isn't it?
Did they respond at all? Were there any sort of... Because on the live videos, you can like send emojis and stuff, can't you? Did they send like a crying face emoji or...
Little casket. Oh, a little ghost, like, signifying an angel.
Yeah.
No, nothing like that, but just
silently watching.
Just silently watch the whole thing. To my knowledge, they never met, so...
Were they eating, do you think?
Dinner?
Well, yeah, just wondering, do you sort of, you know, are you having a bowl of cereal, or you maybe a couple of drinks, just...
What do you eat while watching a funeral? It's a big question.
Were they watching alone? Did the family gather around and...
Well, I mean, yeah, I don't know. I imagine, I can imagine, it was at lunchtime, so this is a sandwich situation.
That was their lunch break. Imagine, sat in the office. What are you watching, Greg? Oh, just this guy went to, it's a long story. Basically, I'm live streaming a funeral, so I want to see how it ends.
Oh, did you know them?
No. No.
Well, no, they wouldn't ask that, would they? They wouldn't ask, did you know them? Because that's really quite heavily implied if you're watching a funeral, isn't it? What was your relationship to them? What do they mean to you? Something like that.
Yeah, well, you know, quite an old estranged friend's grandmother. we never met in life, technically. But, you know, I just want to make sure that she's definitely gone.
So I want to put it out there that... I don't know if we were ever friends.
Oh, right.
I mean, maybe they felt closer to me than I did to them. We were close enough to be Facebook friends, but you know, this was 2008, so everyone was, you know, you would
friend anyone
who was on Facebook in those days. It was a Wild West, Rich.
Yeah, but if you're getting asked that in the office kitchen, you're going to lie. You're going to say you were friends at the absolute minimum. God.
Quite right. Well, it's odd that they chose not to lie about watching the funeral. If you're going to be honest about that, it feels like at that point you might as well.
Yeah, I think we can safely assume...
We didn't have any lessons together.
We can assume this is someone who dispenses with social norms, I think.
yeah.
They're watching the funeral of a stranger.
Oh, dear. Well, that was the that was the funeral. We never had a reawakening per Dragon's Den, but we did... we did have another big party, which was my wedding day, which was quite nice. We've had a lovely review, Rich.
Oh, have we? We want that, don't we? That's what we want from people.
We love it when people leave us reviews, and we always read them out on the podcast. So please do. We love it. It's from Wend 61. Five stars.
Wend 61. Thanks, Wend. Five's the right number.
Five's the right number. We all try and avoid death, and talking about it, so good to hear people tackling the subject in a humorous and refreshing way, makes you think whilst having a laugh.
Wow, what a lovely review.
That's what our podcast is, isn't it? We make you think and we make you chuckle.
Yeah, and we tackle death in a humorous way. That is essentially the synopsis. We could just pop that on as a description from now on, I think. That sums it up more succinctly than either of us ever have.
I don't think we can't self-refer to it as a... I literally can't self-refer to it as a refreshing way, though we can't really say refresh... oh, God, I might not be able to say that word.
No, yeah. Something's gone wrong.
Refreshing. It's not it.
No, it's not... refreshing.
Refreshing, thank you. There we refreshing. Go. Refreshing way. Yes. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Wen61. A lovely review. And if you're listening to this and you have similar feelings, but you haven't yet made them public, please do. I think it's on Apple that we need these reviews, because it helps us. It basically helps us get into some sort of chart, and then that means more people see the podcast and listen to the podcast. And you know the old saying, reviews beget reviews.
Reviews beget reviews, but guests beget guests. It was Dean Burnett this week, and next week we have an absolutely massive guest for you. Huge guest.
She's huge.
She's huge. We've got Michelle Brazier of comedy fame. You might know her. You might know her for her... It's your catchphrase, Rich.
And me saying yeah again for absolutely no reason. Drive myself insane.
You may know her from her stand-up, which is brilliant. You may also know her from her sketches with Auntie Donna, the YouTube comedy group. She is touring in Edinburgh very soon. She'll be doing a month-long stay there. Details will be in next week's show when she appears to talk about death, and it's going to be great.
It is. And what we should say is that so the Dean Burnett episode is the last of the ones that were recorded way, way back in the past. Oh God, so now you're up to date. We're up to date. The Michelle one was recorded 2 weeks ago. We're recording new ones all the time. We're back on track. It's 2023.
We're back on track. It's 2023.
And
these are fresh deaths. And Rich, death comes for us all.
Death comes for us all. It's coming for you, but hopefully not before next week's episode.
It comes to you first.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. We love you.
Bye.
Don't die.